Okay, we are working our way to the end of the highway. Got two more sessions after today, and I look forward to, we're going to spend some time, I think, next week on Jonathan, and then the last week on Job, and a side of Job that you might not have seen before. So I'm going to take a look and just go back over real quickly what we looked at last week, just a couple points there. I thought had a lot of comments via email and stuff about Demas. It was a sobering lesson for all of us, I think. And again, since last week, I've heard two or three more tales of pain and struggle of God's people that have dropped out of the race. I was talking with someone Wednesday night, actually, about the one sport, I think, that probably characterizes or is a metaphor for the Christian life is cross country. If you've ever had any kids that run that, it's pretty amazing parallels, all the excitement and the large numbers at the front end and getting to the end. It's a whole different ballgame. And that's what we saw with Demas last week. I wanted to review three things, and one of them I had drawn on the board, this notion of the relationship between two biblical concepts, one called the world and one called this present age. And I had said that what the Bible calls the present age is really nothing more than a new window through which an ancient rebellion manifests itself. And by that, I simply mean that the world, the Greek word cosmos there, is human society organizing itself to keep God out of the picture. Probably the clearest Old Testament example we have of that is the Tower of Babel. In some ways, I think our modern obsession with bandwidth and instantaneity in our communication is trying to get us to the place, I think, where we've got a modern-day Babel of trying to just exclude God because we can do it all ourselves. If you understand that the cosmos never changes, since Genesis 3, there's been a train that's been created. We talked about this with Adam when we went through Adam, leaving Eden, and the human race is enjoying that ride. And there's a part of us, our Adamic remnant, our Adamic residue, that wants to be on that train, a part that doesn't like God and really loves sin. And that train's moving away. And that's the cosmos in a very real sense. This present age is kind of just that expression of that rebellion at any given point in history. Changes clothing, but same basic ideas. And that's what Demas had been in love with. Demas had just fallen in love with, valued it more than anything else, what he saw right in front of him. Second point, and this is a little bit different way to think of it. We looked at Proverbs, I think it's 4:23 last week, that the above all else, guard your heart, for from it flow the springs of life. And I put in your notes here that our heart is a vault. I think that's a good way to think of it, because it's something that needs to be guarded carefully because of what's in it, all right? But we also need to allow others access to it as men. I think to have a heart that's so closed off that other men don't have access to it in this day and age, beloved, that's a prescription for destruction. The last thing on the planet that we need as men is a life that's so secret no one else has access to it. There's a service called Covenant Eyes. I may have talked to you guys about that. You may have already, some of you probably are familiar with it, but it's a Christian internet accountability deal. Lets you go wherever you want on the internet. There's no filters. You can go wherever you want, but you can't go alone. So myself and my two sons, it's only $4 a month. I bought that for them. You set up this buddy list, and it just keeps track of everywhere you've been, tells what hours you're online. And I've got one of my board members gets a report on all my internet activity every week, and so does one of my kids, and so does someone that's outside my ministry. Too many people fallen on that one, and it's not one easy to recover from. But this idea of protecting our heart but giving someone else the combination, in a sense, is a very, very important modern concept. And as men, we have a hard time being vulnerable, particularly if we're in the professional world, for most of you, or in the ministerial world, for me. There's still that same kind of posturing and all this sort of stuff, if you're not careful, validating your ministry and having numbers and noses to, if you've ever talked to anyone that's been to a pastor's conference, sometimes it's an insidious lot of, everyone brings their trophy case to the conference and they're all baptisms and buildings and all this sort of stuff. We really need someone to help protect our heart. And third one, we looked at this last week with Demas, is that desertion, the actual leaving, is an inner attitude before it's an outer reality. There's really no such thing as a man who walks out on his wife or walks out on his family. He left long ago. His suitcase just never got off the premises. Same with church. When a man gets to the place, and we are classic on this, if you're familiar at all with the statistics on American men in church, we don't do it very well. We leave church long before we quit going to church. Same kind of thing. This is a principle that we saw with Demas, was that Demas had departed before he had deserted, which is what I said last week. And again, this goes back to the second point of having someone that we're accountable to, someone that we talk to. All right. Okay, we're going to take a look at a guy whose name means red. That's what the better dead than red thing is. You'd have to be kind of old to appreciate that McCarthyism from the 50s. I remember it only nostalgically because I was only about 5 when he was saying those sorts of things. So it wasn't, I don't want you to think I was some politically astute young man in the upper Midwest. I wasn't. I was playing kick the can out in the driveway with my friends. So let me read this from Genesis 25, starting with verse 19. These are the generations of Isaac, Abram's son. Abraham fathered Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to be his wife, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" That's what my wife said when she found out she was carrying twins. All right. So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so that they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. You're probably familiar with the other details of the story. It gets worse. He loses his blessing as well. I want to spend some time looking at Esau. He's an amazingly significant person in the New Testament. His name doesn't appear very much at all, but where it does, it's a kind of one of those dash light, check engine light appearances, and we're going to take some time in it. I want to go back through this, and I want to try to explain a couple things that I think are important. We have to look again at Genesis, because the story, the previous story is what leads up to this one. If you remember, Abram, we looked at him a few weeks ago, gets called from Ur of the Chaldees and goes up and way north of Canaan, up in a land called Haran, and then ends up down in Canaan and sojourns there. And God gives him this amazing series of promises. There comes a point, though, when God asks Abram to sacrifice his son. I think you're familiar with that story where he is asked to sacrifice Isaac, his only son. And it's a tremendously important decision in Abram's life. And I want to read just a little bit from that because that's important for this morning. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, this is prior, obviously, to the birth of Jacob and Esau, because Isaac is the child that's here, and Jacob and Esau are Isaac's kids. They're Abram's grandchildren. God tested Abram and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here am I. And he said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. Abram rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac, and he cut the wood for the burnt offering and rose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, it's about a two-day journey, he was in Beersheba, and Moriah, just if you're not familiar with that, Moriah is basically Mount Zion, probably in the area of where Jerusalem was. On the third day, Abram lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abram said to his young man, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and come again to you. And Abram took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. And he took in his hand the fire, which would have been some kind of coals, and the knife. So they went together. And Isaac said to his father, Abram, my father. And he said, here am I, my son. He said, behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abram said, God will provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went both of them together. And when they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there, laid the wood in it, and bound Isaac, his son, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand, took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abram, Abram. And he said, here am I. Don't lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him was a ram caught in a thicket. And Abraham went and took the ram, offered it. Abraham called the name of that place, the Lord will provide. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you. I will surely multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven and as the sand that is on the seashore, and your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in your offspring, all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they rose and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham lived in Beersheba. All right, this is a really important story in light of what we're looking at this morning. What we're going to do is go back over this because I want to try to paint as best I can. I mean, we have lots of gaps in this, but best I can, something of a family history between Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Esau, because we've got to understand what's really going on that day in the field. When Esau comes back tired from whatever and wants some, Campbell's Hearty Man's, beefy dinner soup and sells his birthright for it. And so we're going to kind of go back through this, and I want to paint a picture that may be a little bit broader than what you are accustomed to. All right. A couple things here. In terms of Abram, we're going to go back to Abram. God had appeared and or spoken to Abram five times prior to this incident. Five times prior to this incident. A couple of them were really pretty amazing. An appearance of God where they when they actually did the sign of the covenant, when they cut up these animals and God walked in between them. Some things that Isaac had not seen. All right, and obviously God had a fairly detailed encounter with Abraham prior to the deal with Isaac and the sacrifice of Isaac, because we don't get any indication in the text that God had given him specific instructions where he was to do the sacrifice. He basically said, go to Moriah, which is a whole area. But it says in the text that when he got there, he looked up and he saw the place where he was supposed to do it. So you have this all the time in the Bible where there's really clear indication that there's been a ton of other stuff that went on that we have no record of. So he had this last conversation or this last appearance from God. A couple of them, God actually appeared to him in the form of the angel of the Lord, but or spoke to him. Sometimes it's a vision. But he had five encounters with Yahweh prior to this. Okay. Second point, and I think it's highly unlikely that those in Abraham's household were ignorant of these supernatural encounters. It's not even reasonable to assume that Abraham didn't talk about this stuff. All right. For instance, in Genesis 17, God appears to Abram and tells him that he needs to circumcise Ishmael, who's 14 at this point, and he needs to circumcise himself or be circumcised, and he needs to circumcise all the men in his household as a sign of this covenant that Yahweh was making with this guy named Abraham. All right, so this whole thing's unfolding. And I don't mean to be facetious, but it's inconceivable that he's going to sit down and explain to these guys what he's about to do. And they hadn't been circumcised before. This is kind of new on the radar. And just say, you just got to trust me here, guys. I'm just going to do this little minor surgical procedure on you. No, he's going to explain to them the whole shooting match. That the God of heaven and earth had appeared to him and that this was the sign of this relationship and that I'm doing this out of obedience to you. He would have told them the entire thing about your descendants as numerous as the sand on the seashore, that whole deal, all right? You think of stories that you heard growing up that were less meaningful, less dramatic, but they were perpetuated in the family because they were family stories. That had to have happened, all right? So Isaac, even as a child, had to have had some understanding of this amazing encounter, at least one of them, if not all five of them, that his father had had with God. All right. Third thing, his two of the supernatural encounters here that we read about in Genesis 22 involved this figure called the Angel of the Lord. There's some debate on that, but to me, it's fairly obvious that the angel of the Lord is the Lord. It's the appearance of the eternal Son of God prior to having a body. If you read through the text in Genesis 18, and here it talks about the angel of the Lord, and then all of a sudden the Lord said, angel of the Lord said, the Lord said. And it's just they flop back and forth between the two. This is the heavy thing, is the two passages that I read to you, all right, were heard and witnessed by Isaac. There's absolutely no indication in the text that these were private. Matter of fact, it's the opposite. He's got the knife up, from what we can tell, and it says that the angel of the Lord, a voice from heaven, called to him, Abram, Abram, don't do that. All right? And then what does the voice say? The voice says, now I know that you basically obey and trust me. So you get this statement from heaven that there was something going on between Yahweh, Abraham, and this boy that's on top of this pile of wood, on top of this altar. All right? And you're Isaac and you're hearing this. All right? Then the second time the angel of the Lord speaks, there's no indication that Isaac didn't hear this either, because he spoke from heaven. And I think when God speaks from heaven, it's more than a still small voice on the outside of a cave like he did to Elijah. He goes through the whole Abrahamic covenant verbally about numerous as the sand on the seashore, and your descendants shall own the gates of their enemies, and you're going to be a blessing to the nations, and all this sort of stuff. Isaac's hearing that as well. So here you've got a kid, We don't know how old he is. He's called a boy, so he's probably under, he's 15 or so. He's experiencing all this sort of stuff, all right, which I think is really, really amazing, all right? Number four there, it's reasonable. I put that in quotes because that's kind of a infinite grasp of the obvious. It's reasonable to assume that the father and son had a lot to talk about on the two-day journey back. If Abraham hadn't explained all this stuff to Isaac on the way there, there's no way he's going to avoid it on the way back. They got a two-day journey, and they just have been on the top of Mount Moriah. Isaac's been bound with ropes and put on top of a pile of wood, and he's got his dad's got a sword or knife over his head, about to cut his throat, is what it means to slaughter your son. You do that before a burnt offering, and you have these two angelic voices. You're going to tell me they're not going to talk about this on the way back? All right, this is a whole lot better than a last-minute game down in Tuscaloosa or Auburn. All right, this is heavy stuff, and so they're talking about it on the way back. I think that's a no-brainer. All right, it's also unthinkable, I think, that Isaac's family would not have heard this story repeatedly growing up. This is the stuff legends are made of. This is legendary. All right. And the heavy thing about this, I don't know if you've thought about this, but Isaac, as a boy, has a spiritual experience with the God of the universe that's comparable to what his dad had when he was 75. All right? When Abram was 75 years old, God appeared to him in Genesis 12. And then 25 years later, he has Isaac. Isaac's a boy, and he has this experience with his father and with Yahweh, where a voice from heaven speaks twice. That's pretty big stuff for a child. That would have made an imprint on this kid. And so I think that I'm just trying to build, I think, some evidence for the fact that there's these stories. All right, we're in an oral culture too. We're in an oral culture, no Game Boy, no Wii, no, nothing like that, then no computers, no television. And so when the sun went down, if they were sitting around a fire, they talked. And there was an expectation that the elders in a clan or a family or a tribe would pass on the stories. And so this is just kind of a no-brainer that this story, all the way back from Genesis 12, now through Genesis 22, these stories have been passed on, all right, in Isaac's family for sure, okay? This is, to me, we're getting close to the heart of the issue, because all of this, I think, was available and was known by Esau. That Esau was not ignorant of any of this stuff that had happened to his grandfather or his father. I think this is easily part of the family Thanksgiving stuff that they talk about on holidays, all right? And the sixth point here, because this is where we're starting to get to the heart of it, the birthright that Esau sold for a can of soup there was some financial aspect to it from the book of Deuteronomy. They got a double portion of their whatever was coming to them. But it was spiritual as well. It was profound spiritually, not just personally, financially, all right? What do I mean by that? The firstborn in God's economy, you had to offer your firstborn back to God. And then you had to redeem them back. You had to pay to get your firstborn back, in a sense. It was ritualistic. But God, if you go through Exodus, you go through Deuteronomy, God did this as a constant reminder to his people that they were slaves in Egypt. And he said, the firstborn, everything that opens the womb is mine, and it belongs to me. And then he gave some instructions for how they could buy it back. So there was this very, very, theological is the only word to use. There was a theological label, a theological mindset, a theological reality that went with being the firstborn. It wasn't just that you were the oldest in the family and you got double of dad's estate when he kicked. It was a whole lot bigger than that. God had set it up so that if you were a firstborn, you had this awareness that what what you were spared from, symbolically, is what happened to the Egyptian firstborn. All the firstborn in Egypt were killed. And then God says, the firstborn of Israel are mine. And he goes back. If you read it in Exodus, he goes back and makes the connection between the Egyptians dying and them not dying. And so there's this continuity. You got this amazing story of this promise to Abraham, the blessing that's coming out of it, and all that sort of stuff. And then you also have the fact that this guy is, just by the nature of being a firstborn, is also, he's got this kind of special place in the story of God. Not just the family story, but the story of God as well, from the inception of them as Jews in Exodus. All right? Okay. Based on the blessing, all right, of Jacob, it's obvious to me that Isaac, on his deathbed, believed that the Abrahamic covenant was going to be fulfilled through Esau. Well, where do we get that? Well, Rebecca deceived her husband, whose eyesight was bad, and did all that costuming and stuff on Jacob to get the blessing. At his death, based on Isaac's blessing of Jacob at his death, it's obvious that he assumed that the covenant was coming down through Esau. Makes perfect sense. He was the firstborn. Now, Rebecca had this kind of cryptic thing from God that said the older is going to serve the younger, and that two nations were at war in her womb. But I don't think it's fair to assume that she had this whole thing figured out. I don't think she did. I think she did everything in her power to push her son Jacob, or her favored son Jacob, forward. But when you sit and listen, if you go back and read in Genesis, when Isaac blesses who he thinks is Esau, it's real obvious that he is assuming that it was Abraham, Isaac, Esau, in his mind. That's the Abrahamic covenant flow, all right? So if you take all that together, it impinges, it redefines what Esau did that day in the field, what he despised, what he disregarded, was a whole lot more than just being first at the family reunion kind of thing, all right? Okay. The word that's used here for Esau's attitude towards his birthright, this word despised, thus Esau despised his birthright, is the same word that's used for what Goliath thought of David in 1 Samuel. If you read that story, it says that Goliath disdained David. All right, now what does that mean? All right. Well, you read the story, it's real obvious that what it means is that Goliath really saw David was inconsequential. David was a speed bump on the way to victory. David was nothing. He's this kid that hasn't even shaved yet, for crying out loud. You know, he came bringing a sack lunch for his brothers, and he ends up, he's so small, he can't wear Saul's armor. Saul tries to put his armor on him, and David said, I can't even walk in this stuff, much less fight a giant, you know. So he takes that off, and when he comes out with 5 stones from the brook and a sling and a shepherd's staff, Goliath just mocks him. Why? Because he sees him as inconsequential. He sees him as just nothing. All right, that's the word that's used for what Esau thought of his birthright. It's just no big deal. Inconsequential, unimportant. All right. Second thing here, all right, Esau's decision that day out in the field when he comes back and is mentioned in our New Testaments in the context, and this is something I think is important, reading Scripture in context is vital, in the context of resisting grace and becoming bitter. That's the entrance of Esau into the New Testament. Therefore, lift your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees. Make straight paths for your feet so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather be healed. Strive for peace with everyone and for the holiness without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. That no one is sexually immoral or unholy, is the ESV, like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. So in this context where the writer of Hebrews is issuing this very strong warning about not dropping out of the race, all right, that's how this chapter starts. Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that, you know, and run the race. He talks here, this is a strong warning. He says, be careful that you don't resist God's grace and become bitter, and a whole ton of people become defiled. And then he makes a statement about Esau right in the context of this. And see to it that none of you are immoral or unholy, is the ESV, the NIV, and the New American Standard translate bebelos, the word that's translated unholy here, they translate it godless. All right? And I've taught on Esau before, and I always like to, and I didn't do it this morning, but I always like to ask people, and I can't do it now because you already know, but ask people if they could think of one character in the Bible that they think just captures the word godless, who would it be? And it's always Judas and Jezebel and Ahab, and no one ever thinks of Esau as godless. I mean, and yet in this passage, the writer of Hebrews uses that. It's the only place in the New Testament where this word is used to describe a person. And it's Esau, all right? The word that's ascribed to him, godless, means to walk on something or to profane it. That means to make it vulgar. All right, and vulgar not in the sense of obscene, but vulgar in the sense of just common. To walk on something. And in many ways, there's a number of things here, the long list of them, we'll go through these, but Esau had walked on God by despising his place as the firstborn in the covenant promise. This was a spiritual thing. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't just an inheritance. He'd walked on God. See to it that none of you are godless like Esau, who sold his birthright for a single meal. A single meal, the writer of Hebrews says. That day in the field, Esau basically said, I really don't give a rip about what God's plan is for the fullness of time and where I fit in it. I'm hungry, for crying out loud. What is that to me right now? That was his attitude, all right? He valued the present more than the future, and he valued himself more than his descendants. That last statement is something that we as men are constantly disregarding when we, I think, walk away from relationships, whether it's our spouses, our families. You know, it's interesting to me, having been in the world of Christian education as long as I was, dealing with children from divorce, the impact it makes on children is just so radically different than it makes on adults. I'll never forget talking with a mom in this. Since I moved here, we had a meeting, and she just said, I'm having such a hard time with my daughter. She said, my husband and I divorced 2 years ago, and she said, I've moved on, and she just won't move on. So I've been sitting down trying to get her, honey, you got to just move on. And as graciously as I could, I said, ma'am, I said, there's something you're really missing here. And she said, what's that? And I said, he's your ex-husband, but he's never going to be her ex-father. I said, the relationship that your daughter has with that man will never end. I said, it's not a social, legal arrangement. It's a biological arrangement. She has his blood coursing through her veins. She'll probably never get over it. Which is true. I've got one of my favorite students is 30 years old, and she's still wrestling with it. Her dad was married and divorced 4 times. And I use that illustratively, in a sense, Esau really didn't care about his descendants. Esau didn't really care about his family. He didn't care about the covenant promise of God. He said he valued the present more than the future. He valued himself more than his descendants. All right? Now, let me clarify something here, because this is where we're going to start to put the cookies here on the bottom shelf. Third thing is that godlessness is not ungodliness. Godlessness is not ungodliness. Those are two separate words, not only in Greek, but in fact. And we've got to be really careful about confusing those, which I think we do. They are very, very different, all right? Ungodliness is flagrant and behavioral. All right? The works of the flesh are evident: sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, fits of anger, rivalries, dissensions, divisions, envy, drunkenness, orgies, and things like these. That's ungodliness. It's flagrant. It's behavioral. You can see it. All right? Godlessness is hidden, and it's spiritual. It's not behavioral. Godlessness was what was going on in Esau's heart. Godlessness was what characterized Esau. The decision was just an illustration of it. It was just an example of it. The decision wasn't godlessness. The decision came out of godlessness. Esau was godless, not the decision. All right. All right, now let me take this in. We're going to drive this home. We're going to get nervous here, but that's good, right? That's good. Godlessness is, here's what it is. This is my definition of it, and I think it'll stick. Godlessness is excluding God from places where he belongs. It's excluding God. Godlessness is excluding God from places where he belongs. All right? And I'm going to say this now, and I'll probably say it again, because I think I want to get our attention. I think that godlessness is the most common and most, and this is not in your notes, but godlessness is the most common and most serious sin among respectable Christians. Godlessness, not ungodliness. Godlessness, I think, is the most common and serious sin among respectable Christians, which is us. I think the us in this room, all right? And I'm going to get a little bit more specific here what it is. But the basic thing is it's excluding God from places where he belongs. And I don't necessarily mean geographical places. I mean situations where he belongs, all right? If you look at this passage just to the left of your notes there from 2 Timothy, understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty, for people will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. There's ungodliness, all right? Having the appearance of godliness, but denying its power. Avoid such people. Having an appearance of godliness, but denying its power. That's godlessness. And in a very real sense, in your notes here, there's such a thing, and I want you to, I'm going to say this slowly, there's such a thing as godless godliness. That sounds like a semantic type tongue twister. But there is such a thing as godless godliness. That's what Paul's talking about here. People who have a form of godliness but deny its power. God's not in it. There's a form of godliness, but God's not in it. It's a godless godliness. And that right there, beloved, is something that we struggle with as respectable Christians, is excluding God from places where he belongs. But we have this appearance of godliness because we're respectable. And we've made this mistake that godlessness is ungodliness, and it's not. Ungodliness is, you know, you can be a fire-breathing, gun-toting pimp in the urban center and be ungodly, all right? You can be a respectable father or mother in the carpool line at a Christian school and be godless. You can be the valedictorian at a Christian school and be godless. You can have done nothing worse than kick the cat and be godless. All right? It's different from ungodliness. It's having this form of godliness, but denying the power of it. All right. Now here's where this gets heavy. Paul says in 2 Timothy 2, all right, and this is a very strong statement, and this is where we need to be sober as men. Paul says that godless talk leads to ungodly behavior. Godless talk leads to ungodliness. Paul says that. He said, avoid godless chatter, because those who indulge in it become more and more ungodly. So if ungodliness is this flagrant disregard of the law of God and just sin, flagrant behavioral sin, and godlessness is leaving God out of places where he belongs, Paul says godless talk, all right, now get this, this is important. If you understand what godlessness is, godless talk is conversation where God has been left out and he really belongs there. That's what godless talk is. Godless talk is not cursing and profanity. That's ungodly talk. Godless talk is conversation between us as men where God really ought to be in the conversation somehow and we've kept him out. All right? To me, the best example that I have that I can latch on is, and this is where I think it's really, we need to be careful, because in among respectable Christians, conventional wisdom becomes synonymous with the will of God. In other words, this kind of what I've learned through the school of hard knocks and what I've picked up growing up, that's what I pass on to my children. And so you have us as dads or us as men helping our kids make decisions for college, helping them pick a college, and God's not anywhere in the conversation. Even to talk to a child and say, we've got, you know, we really want to spend this as a junior or sophomore, really spend the next 8 months, we're just going to be praying that God will make it clear where he wants you to go to college. You know, the assumption is you just follow this path. I mean, I met kids when I moved here, they knew where they were going to college from before they were born. Was decided for them. It's like some kind of academic election, you know, like a theology of election. You went here. And I'm not saying we can't go to the same schools that our parents went to and that sort of stuff, but to not even consider the will of God when it comes to something like that. Now, that's a huge decision. It's probably where you're going to meet your spouse, all kinds of stuff. That can be godless, all right? And so it's not just common sense. Wisdom is seeing life from God's point of view. Wisdom is seeing life the way God sees it, and God sees it the way he saw it when he gave it to Abraham. Esau said, I don't really give a rip about that. I'm hungry. This is what this makes sense to me to do this right now, and that's what I'm going to do. All right?
I'm going to ask you a question. You know, you've got wisdom in this too. You see just as many people that say, you know, great, I'm going to go off and do something and get $120,000 in student loans to send my kid to Sanford because I think it's God's will, and that you look at wisdom and God would say, you know, there's this whole set over here. So somewhere, you know, of course the first step in wisdom is respecting, fearing God. Mm-hmm. So you're playing in that game too. I mean, that's the first step, but then there's wisdom. And you see both sides getting flipped.
Yeah.
I mean, I see just as many people that I would say are on this side and skip over any wisdom thought. And somehow, you know, I'm just saying it can be a very difficult, discerning time to make these kind of, and what is a moral decision? What's an amoral decision? I mean, most of our decisions in life are not moral.
Right, right. No,
there are a lot of wisdom decisions.
No, they are. But David, I think that the issue here, and I'm going to be hard on this because I heard this as Christians to say, I think it's God's will that my son or daughter go and do this. My experience with that, and I've got 3 decades of it working with families, my experience is that's a cliche.
I agree.
That's a cliche. You know, tell me that you've gone away for a weekend and you've fasted and you've prayed and we've gone before God and we've been praying about this for 6 months. That, even that to me, doesn't guarantee that you're gonna make a right choice. But that's what I mean when I'm talking about a godly decision. I put very little stock in the fact that, you know, that's like saying, I have a stewed tomato in my right sneaker and it gives me great purpose in life. You can call me crazy, but you can't judge that because that's totally subjective. And when Christians say, well, we believe it's God's will that we do such and such, that's no different than when a Mormon just says, well, the Spirit testifies with my spirit that Mormonism is true. When they say that, you're done talking. They've just stepped through the wall and gone into the world of subjectivity. I say this because it's an example. And my daughter Havilah, when she was a senior at Briarwood, she sat me down one day and she said, "Daddy," she said, "I don't understand." She said, "Why is picking a college so hard for us, or for me, and so easy for my friends?" I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "They don't even think about it." She said, "They've already just, from the time they started junior high, they knew where they were going to college, and they just are going to go to college." And she said, "We're trying to figure out not just finances, but where do I go?" You know, and it was awful. It was agonizing for us. And that was a very brief conversation, but it really captured the fact that we're trying to figure this out. And whether or not we made the perfect decision is not the issue as much as, you know, if a child ends up at Auburn or ends up at Alabama, which is where almost all the kids at Briarwood went, okay, that's fine. The route that it took them to get there, to me, is the thing we've got to be careful of, because the issue of ungodliness being the thing that Christians are supposed to avoid. All right, I don't smoke, drink, or chew, or take out girls that do. All right, that's the ungodliness. But the godlessness is what Esau did. Esau made plans. Esau did all kinds of stuff with no regard whatsoever. You know, I was on a mission trip with the kid, and he said, "Mr. Shaka," he said, "I really want you to pray about whether or not I should go into medicine." I said, "I will." I said, "We need to add a second prayer to that." He said, "What's that?" I said, "You need an answer to two things. Number one is whether, and the second one is where." I said, "If the assumption on your part is that once God says you're supposed to go into medicine, that means you live in the suburbs and have 2.8 kids and do all this sort of stuff," I said, "that's presumption." I said, "God may want you to practice medicine in the rural areas of Alabama rather than in the suburbs." I said, "That's a valid thing for you to seek as well." Okay, that's what we're talking about here, is that living a life circumspectfully of the will of God and the plan of God. It's His story, not mine. It's His story. Okay, second thing, third thing, wherever we are, godless talk leads to ungodly behavior. Here's some examples of that. And David, I think, the illustration that he gave, in a very real sense, comes right out of James. One of them is planning with no thought of God. And by no thought of God, I don't mean a passing prayer before we eat lunch on Sunday. That's not what I mean. I mean, it's a. I knew a dad that took his daughter away for a weekend, just for them to try to spend time quietly praying and seeking God's face over where to go to college. All right. Is that a formula? It's not a formula, but to me, that's so much more important than dads taking their kids to a ranch in California for a week, if that's all they're going to do. JH is a marvelous ministry. God's used it in the lives of a lot of people I know. But as fathers, I need to have the same kind of dedication to the larger decisions of life as well. Planning, I think building programs, expansions, whether it's in business, whether it's in churches. You know, David, in 2 Samuel 7, David wanted to build a temple for God. Great idea. God's living in a tent. He's living in a palace. He said, "I can't sleep at night. I'm going to build a temple." The prophet Nathan says, "Do it, man. That's a great idea. Makes perfect sense. Yahweh, tent, David, palace. Let's flip that." And so he says, "Do it." Well, that night God appears to Nathan and says, "Wrong. I'll get a temple, but this guy ain't building it. This guy's a warrior. He's got blood all over his hands. I'm going to have his son Solomon build it. Good idea, wrong time." And so Nathan's got to come back. You try to find how many times in the Bible when a prophet comes back and said, "I screwed up." It just never happens. Nathan has to go back to David and said, "God appeared to me, and that was wrong. Good idea, wrong time." Planning without God. Worship that's restricted to church. Beautiful passage in Ezekiel chapter 33, where God talks about his people and makes some really heavy statements about their perspective on worship. And it's basically worship as entertainment, worship as what you can get out of it. As for you, son of man, your people who talk together about you, he's talking about Ezekiel, talk about you by the walls and in the doors of the houses, say to one another, each to his brother, come and hear what the word that is comes from the Lord. I hear that all the time. Have you heard this guy preach? Oh, gosh, you've got to hear this guy preach. Got to hear this guy preach, you know. And so you go to this church to hear this guy preach. They come to you as people come. They sit before you as my people, and they hear what you say, but they won't do it. For with lustful talk in their mouths they act, their heart is set on their gain, and behold, you are to them like one who sings emotional songs with a beautiful voice and plays well on an instrument, for they hear what you say, but they won't do it. In other words, when they're at the temple, everything's hot. They get out of the temple, they go back to business as usual. And so worship, godless worship, is worship that only occurs in a certain building at a certain time of the week. That's godless worship. That's holding a form of godlessness. Third thing, location-specific vocabulary. James talks about this. In Isaiah, God says, these people draw near to me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In other words, when they're in temple, they talk real spiritual, but then when they get outside it, they don't. They draw near to me with their mouth, but I don't have their hearts. James says that with our mouth, we bless the Lord and curse our brother who's made in God's image. All right. In other words, he said this is in the passage that's talking about, you know, salt water and fresh water and, you know, brambles and figs and all this. So it's kind of like you got two kinds of things going on here. When you're around Christian people, you bless God. When you're around other people, you talk differently. All right. And this is a challenge for us as men. And I can't pretend to have an answer to it, but I do think it's important for us to have one vocabulary, to have one language, and to not to talk a certain way when we're around a certain group of people and talk a different way when we're around a different group of people, all right? I don't know what that means, all right? It may mean that we get rid of the pseudo-spiritual vocabulary on this side and then also get rid of the vulgarity on this side and just be, you know, a regular person. I reject the idea that there's such a thing as locker room talk. I just do, for a believer. You cannot support that from Scripture, all right? And so I just need to be consistent. A godless attitude is one that has mixed vocabularies for different audiences, all right? I'm around this group of buddies when I'm at the hunting cabin so I can talk this way, but when I'm in Sunday school, I certainly wouldn't talk that way. And I'm just saying, no, let's get rid of that and let's be consistent in the middle. Last one, excluding God from conversations where he belongs leads to excluding him from decisions where he belongs. That's Paul's principle. Godless talk leads to more and more ungodliness, you know. And I'll be the first to admit, this is awkward among men. It just is, you know, to ask a brother, you know, what do you think God has in this, you know. Our typical response is kind of a bumper sticker theology where we say stuff like, well, you know, God works all things together for good. Well, it's bigger than that. It's bigger than that, all right? Couple questions here and we'll wrap it up. How many of the last few major decisions you've made, investment, spending, time, commitments, were preceded by conversation that deferred to God? Talking with another believer, another male believer, and not just getting counsel, what do you think I should do, but just trying to lay out on the table that you really want to do the will of God. I have to believe that when God hears one of his children that are eager to do his will, he's up off the throne, he's active, he's doing things. But just a lot of times I think we make decisions based on experience, based on what just seems to be the most common sense thing. And I'm not talking about finding a parking spot here or whether or not to get a kiwi or a cabbage at the grocery store. I'm talking about major decisions, career, relocation, That sort of stuff. Second, did the last conflict you had with your spouse involve any mention of the Lord and His will for you as a couple? I'd love to tell you that I'm good at this and I'm not. But my wife, when we're in the middle of a conflict, she has this amazing thing and it just shuts it down. She'll look at me and she'll say, "Where's the Lord in all this?" You know? What do you say to that? You're going to get mad? You're going to accuse her of being super spiritual? She's not being super spiritual. She's cutting right to the heart of it. Where is the Lord in this? Because we kind of have the sense that when we're mad, we don't, God, you know, I'll deal with that later. Right now I'm dealing with this. No, this is God. A godly attitude is He's here. What does He want for me as a husband? What does He want for our marriage? Who's our real enemy anyway? Is our real enemy the person that I love? Or is our real enemy the one who hates Christ and hates the gospel and hates God and has got us fighting against each other? Third one, how often is the Lord, not church, not Christian stuff, not politics, not whatever, a part of the conversations I have with members of this church? This one's a hard one for us as men, but I think, you know, we talk accurately about Christian stuff, we talk accurately about God, but I wonder if we feel the liberty to talk affectionately about our Father with one another. You know, to be able to say to another guy over coffee, you know, gosh, the Lord really spoke to me this morning or spoke to me last week. I was reading in the Word and just stood out to me. I think it would be so good, an antidote against godlessness for us from time to time as men to be able to share with one another what I'm guessing a chunk of you spend time, I know some of you do, spend time with the Lord in this book on a regular basis. And I know God's talking to you through a sermon, through something you saw. So, bottom line, godlessness is just excluding God from places where He belongs. Conversation, decisions, and it's serious because it leads to ungodly behavior. Okay, let me pray.